Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Recruitment and Retention of a Qualified Workforce teleconference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions on how to participate will be given at that time. If anyone requires operator assistance during the call, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, today's conference call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Ms. Mary O'Brien. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Mary O'Brien, and on behalf of the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, I'd like to welcome you to today's session, Recruitment and Retention of a Qualified Workforce, Lessons Learned. In a minute, I'm going to turn this over to Frieda Bernatovich, who will be moderating today's call. But first, I want to just go over a few logistics. The phone lines that the participants have called in on are closed right now, as the operator just said, and we'll keep them closed during the presentations just to keep background noise down. If you are having any technical issues during the session, you can dial star zero on your phone, and an operator will assist you. We will be pausing between presentations today for questions and comments, so at that point, the operator will give you instructions for how to speak up, and he'll open your line. So please note any questions that you have as people are speaking. We'd really like to hear from you and have this be as interactive as possible. For today's session, everyone is on an audio line, but we have also offered participants an option to click on the link in your email to get to a website where you can watch the PowerPoint slides live during today's presentation. If you don't want to do that, or if you don't have that email, or if you're not at a computer, or if you're having technical difficulties, it's no problem. You can just listen on the audio line. All of the handouts, including the PowerPoints, are posted on our website. I'm going to give you that link, and it was also in the email you got with the phone number for today. You can go there and see the PowerPoints now or after the call to print them out. The website is www.nrcoi, standing for National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, .org. That's www.nrcoi.org. Click on teleconferences and then on the date. That website has the three PowerPoint presentations you'll see today. It also has a document called Recruitment and Retention Grantees that provides information and resources from all of the eight Recruitment and Retention Grantees. We've also provided a link to the Child Welfare Information Gateway site on workforce issues as a resource. Before we begin, I want to give you an idea of the audience today. We have registrations from over 35 states, both state agencies and county agencies, along with partners from provider agencies and from universities. We also have some federal regional office staff with us today and a few others from national organizations. So welcome to everyone, and thanks for coming. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Frieda Bernatovich for a few more remarks, and then we'll begin.
Thank you, Mary, and welcome, everybody. As Mary said, this is the third in a series of teleconferences on recruitment and retention of a qualified workforce, reporting from the eight grantees funded by the Children's Bureau 5 years ago to explore these issues and develop promising strategies. We had such a good time working together that all eight of us decided to go in together to submit a proposal for a National Child Welfare Workforce Institute that was funded by the Children's Bureau this year, and we were successful in getting that funding, so we're going to have the pleasure of working together for another 5 years. And we hope that through this institute, some of the things that we have learned can be disseminated through training for mid-managers and supervisors and through traineeships and a dissemination effort. We have a website for that institute that we have just developed and will be operational soon, and the address for that website is ncwwi.org. That's for the National Child Welfare Workforce Institute.org. I would like to welcome the regional office representatives on this teleconference and to say that we will be having another teleconference for that group on Tuesday, December the 16th at 2 o'clock. That's being organized by Donna Hornsby, and I hope you'll be able to participate and hear from all of the grantees at that point about their work. So let me quickly introduce our presenters today. First, we have from New York State, Mary McCarthy and Paul Brady. From Michigan, we have Gary Anderson. And from Iowa, we have Miriam Landsman and Margie Poorman. So welcome, everyone, and let's begin with the presentation from New York State.
Thank you, Frida. Hi, everybody. My name is Mary McCarthy, and I'm the director of the Social Work Education Consortium, and we have had one of the 8 recruitment and retention grants. And I'm just going to tell you a little bit of background about New York's turnover problems and some of the ideas that emerged from our work, and then quickly turn this over to Commissioner Paul Brady, who is a local district commissioner, who can really talk, I think, more concretely about actually how local district leadership works to try to improve the organizational climate related to recruitment and retention. So I'm really thrilled that Commissioner Brady can join us today. He's the real expert in this area. New York, as you can see from the slides, is a state-supervised and county-administered system, which is true of about 14 states in the country. So we have a lot of variability from county to county. Just some examples, we have counties with a total child welfare workforce of less than 25 to New York City with a child welfare workforce exceeding 6,000 and individual boroughs that have more than 1,000 child welfare staff in the public sector with 5 or 6 field offices. We have tried to track turnover by county and recently by borough in New York City. So we've learned a lot about how many people leave per year, but we don't have a lot of longitudinal data on why people leave, from what units, are they new workers. We don't know a lot of detail about them. So, Mary, if you could go to the second slide. So high turnover in some ways is anecdotal. We originally thought of it as a universal problem, but in studying it, just the numbers, we learned the turnover is actually very cyclical, can be localized, and may be structural in nature. So understanding that allows us to think about, well, what interventions might actually make a difference. Can you go to the next slide, please? So we did some research with the local district commissioners who had high turnover and learned a lot about why caseworkers want to leave and what might encourage them to stay. We also found a tremendous amount of consistency among workers. And you can see from the slide there are things that we've learned from national research as well. Burnout, administrative practices, pay, paperwork, all were consistent themes that we heard. Next slide. So what changes might encourage workers to stay were things like reduced caseload size, increase in pay. But what we learned that local districts have a lot of control over are administrative policies and procedures and feelings of respect from others inside and outside of the agency. So with this knowledge, we developed an organizational intervention. If you could go to the next slide. And that was around creating design and improvement teams in local districts that were comprised of workers, supervisors, and managers from across the spectrum of the agency. And they were specifically, the work that we did with them was specifically around making the group a team, creating very specific tasks that they would focus on. We used the logic model tool very consistently to help people focus on the work and action strategies, and figuring out how to balance through these teams both the social and the functional side of work. Workers need a place and staff need a place to debrief and learn from each other, but we also have to focus on what are our goals and how are we accomplishing them, so that we worked hard to try to get some actions and outcomes that were very obvious to the staff in terms of the issues and problems and challenges that they thought were influencing retention and turnover in their agency. We also did a very comprehensive evaluation, and that evaluation report will be available on the Child Welfare Information Gateway around the end of January, so that we've tried to learn a lot with and from the local districts that participated with us in this design team work. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Commissioner Brady to actually talk about how this theory or concept worked in real life.
Thank you, Mary. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Paul Brady. I'm the commissioner for the Schoharie County Department of Social Services. I've been the commissioner here since 1998. Prior to that, I had worked for 13 years in another contiguous county, so I've got a fair number of years of experience in human services. And, when I came to Schoharie County, one of the things that was an issue for us almost immediately was the issue of turnover. And, I really want to try to put this in some sort of a context. So you should see slide 9 up there that provides a little bit of a demographic picture for the county. Now, we are the fifth smallest county in the state. We're very rural. You can see that we have a population of just over 32,000. We only have 18 caseworkers for our entire Family and Children's Services Division. I do like to mention that because oftentimes when I'm talking to my peers in New York City, they have a tendency to laugh at me if you have 50% turnover, you're only talking about 9 staff. But in terms of, functional impact, it is significant for us because, you can see that, if you look, for example, at, our child abuse unit, I have 1 senior caseworker. I have 5 caseworkers. That's been a relatively recent development that we've gone to a staffing pattern of 5. I had traditionally had 3. Then we went to 4. And then within the last year, we've added a 5th person. So that, when I lost, and this actually did happen back in 2001, we lost 3 of the 4 workers that were in that unit. That was a pretty significant impact to our Child Protective Service. And trust me, I had a number of conversations with the Child Protective Worker who stayed during that fall, and she was looking for a job just as hard as she could because she realized we're going into a new school year, and she's the sole person that I have. And to be able to recruit, hire, and get somebody trained to the point where they're case assignable is a pretty complicated task. But providing that little bit of background, I'd like to move to the next slide. This is an indication of what our turnover rate was for 2000 through 2003. And you can see that in 2000, it was relatively small. It was dramatic for the next couple of years. And it was having an adverse impact on our ability to provide service. And I had perceptions about, what was driving that, and that's actually on the next slide. Now, these are my perceptions, all right, and, I'm not going to pretend to be the sharpest tool in the shed. I thought it was all related to the salary, the benefits, the caseload, and connections. I guess, this means something to people from New York. Connections is our SACWIS system, all right, and without editorializing, I've been less than satisfied with it. I've always seen it as being somewhat cumbersome. But I was convinced that, these were essentially the elements that were contributing to turnover for at least our agency. And I have to tell you, I was quite wrong about that. Can we go to the next slide? Now, this slide indicates – now, this was data that was actually collected by the School of Social Work. Now, this was part of a survey that was done of 13 high-turnover counties, and we were obviously one of them. And this was startling to me because, you can see, if you don't have the slide in front of you, it surveyed questions relative to caseload, pay and benefits, respect, paperwork, environment, administrative solutions, reduced stress, and autonomy. Now, if you remember the previous slide, you know, I was pretty convinced that it was going to be caseload, it was going to be the pay, the benefits issue, our SACWIS system. But that's really not what people from my agency were saying was contributing to why they were leaving. And in fact, if you look at the single largest issue that they identified, it was administrative solutions. Now, you know, keep in mind, we're a very small agency. There are basically two administrators in my office. There's a deputy commissioner and there's myself. So when I see that, you know, over 57% of the staff are indicating that there are administrative solutions that need to be put in place in order to stem the turnover, you know, I've got to take a hard look at, you know, personally, what am I doing or not doing that's really contributing to this? And, you know, this was a pretty difficult task. And this is when, you know, we got into the whole issue of the design teams. And, you know, I did this with some trepidation because, you know, my biggest concern is, you know, what are people going to say? Are they going to indicate that, you know what, we'd be far better off if Brady wasn't the commissioner? And, you know, surprisingly and thankfully, I guess, that wasn't the case. Now, our design team got off the ground and was facilitated by staff from the SUNY Albany School of Social Work. And I cannot give them enough credit for the outstanding work that they did, because what they were doing is they were actually coming on site and they were meeting with our team. Now, our team consisted of basically casework, senior casework staff, from within the Family and Children's Services Division. And we were really looking at issues that either unnecessarily complicated our work or were contributing factors to turnover. And what was interesting to me about this was that I wasn't sure, you know, when you look at the issue of administrative solutions, what exactly are we talking about? And I was surprised at those items that were identified by the staff. And, you know, what we ended up doing was really working on what were root causes for some of these problems. You know, were they connected to our turnover issue, and what were potential solutions? And the design team really took this task to heart. You know, what they did was they would identify an issue, and then they would come up with potential solutions for it. And it was interesting because you can see some of the things that they worked on. These are not things that I necessarily would have considered. I mean, it was related to our on-call system. Now, our casework staff are all required to participate in our on-call system. It's done on a rotational basis, and it's basically coverage for after hours. But we had a system that was pretty dysfunctional. People did not want to voluntarily participate. But what we did through the design team is we really put the issue in their hands to come up with potential solutions to it. And they took it on and they came up with a system that has completely revitalized our on-call to the point now where it used to be a voluntary sign-up. Now I've got so many volunteers that participate, it has become a situation where the biggest complaints I hear now are that people can't get on-call and they'd like to get on-call. They came up with even in a rural county, I would have never expected parking to be a problem, but it was. It was related to where we park our official cars, because there was a point in time where they were actually required to be parked off-site from where our building is located, and that was needlessly complicating their work and was requiring significant time on their part to be able to catch a ride to where the vehicles were parked in order to be able to take one to be able to go out into the field. They've come up with a process internally for the all of our casework staff are responsible for drafting their own legal pleadings, but it was kind of a catch-as-catch-can system that we had in place, and they came up with a very specific process that minimizes the number of revisions that are made, tracks it so that it doesn't get lost between the point where it's being drafted and it's actually delivered to me for my signature. Probably the most significant thing was related to the drafting of policy statements. The design team really got into identifying issues, for example, case transfers between units, completion of progress notes, family assessment plans, and being very clear about how those activities were to be undertaken. And what they would do is that they would essentially take on the task of drafting the policy statement. They would submit it to me for my review, and you know, I obviously had the opportunity to make comments. But for the most part, they were so well thought out that really all I had to do was just simply okay them, and then they would take responsibility for actually presenting them to their peers in our division meetings. And you know, what I found was is that we got significant buy-in from the staff in terms of these types of policy documents, because they were theirs. They had ownership for them. And I mean, it was really kind of remarkable in terms of their implementation, the ease with which that actually took place. And it wasn't the type of a circumstance where it's being dictated from, for example, my office down to the line staff. It's really coming from the line staff. And I think that they were certainly in a much better position to understand the day-to-day operations and develop a system that was going to be in tune with those day-to-day activities. Now, the next thing I'm actually looking at having them take on is an issue related to our overtime. Overtime is somewhat problematic for us in terms of the amount of money that we budget for it. Typically, we run short from one year to the next. But I've really thought that what I want to do over the course of the next couple of months is turn this over to our design team and say, look, here is the issue. We're obviously in tough financial times. I need to have a system that is going to make sure that we're operating a system related to overtime that is going to be financially manageable, but at the same time be at least responsive to the fact that there are going to be those circumstances with cases where we're going to have to authorize overtime in an on-call situation or extending the workday, and I really want them to have input into that process. So that's essentially what we're looking to do. Now, what happened as a result of this? Let's go to the next slide. You can see what's happened. I mean, and trust me, I don't consider this to be, I mean, it's not as if we've gotten to an end destination. You know, this is always kind of a process that's in place, and we're constantly trying to be attuned to it. But you can see what's happened with our turnover. I mean, it's dramatically come down from where it was in 2000 through 2003. To 2004, 2007, we haven't had a year yet where we've been over 15%. And I give a lot of credit to the Social Work Consortium, the staff that have participated in the process, and I give all the credit in the world to our staff here in the office, because they really have been active participants in this, and I think that they deserve a great deal of credit. So with that said, I guess I'll conclude, or I'll turn it back over to Mary.
Thanks, Paul. And I think the take-home message for me has always been that Commissioner Brady, when this started, he took a big risk. Like he said, I wasn't sure what was going to happen. It was the unknown. And everything that we've learned about leadership is about moving into the unknown, taking risks, but trusting your staff to be able to work with you to find solutions together. And I think it's the combination of the leadership, the vision, the confidence in the staff, and then staff really rise to that occasion in very positive and strengths-based ways. Now, we did this intervention in six counties, including one of the boroughs in New York City, and serendipitously, we had a follow-up study on workers' intention to leave in 2005, a couple of years after we started the design team intervention, and every single district that we had an active design team in had showed a significant, statistically significant decrease in the number of workers saying that they were looking for another job. But the same high turnover counties that we did not do the intervention in had no decrease in the percentage of workers looking for another job. So we feel like we have a small bit of evidence that shows that it's possible that this intervention really does begin to work on the climate and culture within the organization. We also found, Mary, if you could go to the common themes slide, we also found that there were common themes across all the teams. And remember, we're talking about teams that were in very, very different organizational environments in terms of size and caseload size and communities that they're practicing in. So we're talking about New York City, Schoharie County, and other small and medium-sized counties upstate. Just about all of the teams identified safety, job descriptions, recognition and respect, vicarious trauma or secondary traumatic stress, life work fit, communication within the organization, and legal issues as things that influence workers' decision to stay or go. And so what we invited the design teams to do is just what Paul talked about. Focus on one or two of those, come up with some very specific action plans, and work towards making changes in the organizational climate, in practice, in policy, that would improve these things, life-work fit and communication and the others that I mentioned. We also learned a number of lessons in how to implement these teams in ways that made them effective within the organization. And some of those things are on the final slide. We really needed the facilitators. We needed to model the behavior we were trying to encourage in the teams, which was recognition and respect for each other, democratic practices within the team, getting to the work quickly so that people really began to see solutions in place. What I think hinders a team and takes away motivation is if all you do is meet. What they need to see is that they have ideas, they suggest action plans, and that the administration really takes them seriously, and they can actually see a difference in the way the agency is operating fairly quickly. We found that we had to stay solution focused, that we couldn't get sucked into problems and negative processes, that if people came to complain to the design team meetings, we had to ask them to please turn that around so that what they came with were solutions, that these weren't complaint sessions, but that the design team meetings were really structured to identify and move quickly to solutions. We also tried to use data and not just squeaky wheels, that how much evidence is there that something is a real problem within your organization so that it was responsive to the larger group of workers. We also found that we needed representation at all meetings by upper-level management, that often by having the deputy commissioner in the meeting, first of all, there was open communication, and secondly, staff began to see administration as solution-focused and action-oriented, as taking their concerns seriously. It helped direct line staff learn how to communicate effectively with management. And also, often, managers got things done instantly, that the deputy commissioner or the commissioner could leave the meeting, make a phone call, and come back and say, that's done. We also found that management and supervision consultation are essential, so that as the work began to proceed, Commissioner Brady and some of the other commissioners asked us to come in and actually work on building team cultures among groups of supervisors and managers as well, and that helping those teams learn how to work effectively together also allowed the design team to be more effective. So that's what we have to share with you today. And as I said, our final report will be on the Child Welfare Information Gateway and also on the National Child Welfare Workforce Institute website by the end of January. And I really thank you for this opportunity to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Mary and Paul. That was a great presentation. We have time for maybe one question. Can we open the lines if anyone has a question?
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment, please press the 1 button on your touch-tone keypad. Again, if you'd like to queue up to ask a question, please press the 1 button on your touch-tone keypad. I'm showing no questions from the phones at this time.
Great. Great. Thank you, Matthew. Let's go on to Gary from Michigan.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Gary Anderson. I'm the director of the School of Social Work at Michigan State University, located in East Lansing, Michigan, which is the capital of the state of Michigan. And I just would like to talk a bit about our recruitment and retention project. And first, to give you a little bit of background about the state of Michigan, we have a centrally administered child welfare system, but there's also considerable leadership that comes out of each of the 83 counties. In addition to our 83 counties and central leadership, we also have about 60 private agencies. In some Michigan counties, 100% of the child welfare services are provided by private agencies. In others, about 50%, and then in some counties, all the services are provided by the public agency. For the state, you know, when you look at turnover, the just kind of pinning down certain numbers is tough to do, but in general, we found that in the public agency, the turnover rates varied from 20% to as high as 80% in some counties on an annual basis. We found that consistently private agencies had higher rates of turnover, hovering usually around an average of close to 40% of their foster care and adoption workers leaving on an annual basis. Consequently, for the Michigan State Project, in addition to working with the public agency, we also wanted to include our private agencies in this mix. Like New York State, we kind of pose a geographically interesting state because we have Detroit and an urban environment in southeast Michigan where the majority of the kids are in care for the system. But we also have pretty remote areas in the Upper Peninsula and in northern Michigan that are very rural counties. So I think in a lot of ways, geographically, we look a lot like New York with the large urban centers and then the fairly remote areas as well. Most of our work is going to be in the more populated counties as the turnover rates in the more rural and northern counties is generally low. And as we know from our anecdotal evidence and from conversations with New York, that just because turnover rates are low doesn't mean that people are necessarily happy. But at least they're not leaving, which again can be good or bad depending on a variety of circumstances. So let me just talk briefly about our project. The first thing I want to do is to talk about the different things that we did. And what we did was we set up five different aspects to this. The first one was a series of assessment activities. We thought that whatever we did in the course of this five-year study that we needed to look very closely at how things were being assessed and to use that as a basis for what we were building. The second thing we did was curriculum building, where we were working on primarily the signature part of our project is to build a retention-focused curriculum for supervisors. The third part was supervisory training. Then we lastly engaged in intensive relationships with two particular agencies, and then we did other training. And I think these slides are going way too fast. There we go. So let me just so those are the things we build this on. The other thing I just want to mention is something about values. We really began this process as a collaborative effort with the Michigan Department of Human Services, with the Federation for Children and Families, and also then with Michigan State. And so in that, okay, folks, I'm going to try to move these myself if that's okay.
Yep.
Okay. So when I looked at collaboration, one of my favorite quotes was, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And so we chose to work with partners at every step of the way. We were guided by an advisory committee of about 18 people during this process. And I would think that, that there are probably moments in the state of Michigan when we were the most civil group in existence between the private public agencies and the schools of social work. That there was a lot of controversy and a lot of political difficulties over these 5 years, and we maintained this steady commitment to partnership throughout this and tried to, in some ways, model the things that we were going to end up studying and teaching. So first I want to talk about the findings from our assessment activities. The first thing that we did was we asked, why do workers and supervisors stay? What are the factors that contribute to resiliency? Because based on a literature review, it seemed like the reasons why they leave was pretty well confirmed over and over again by almost every study in child welfare or in just about any industry group. So I wanted to find out, were there some things that were particularly powerful for having workers and supervisors stay and to use this as the basis, again, for some of our curriculum building. So we interviewed 23 workers and supervisors from private agencies who had 3 or more years experience, and their supervisors still describe them as kind of vibrant, effective, high-functioning people within their agencies, because, again, we didn't always equate longevity with effectiveness. From this, basically 4 qualities emerged. The first one was a commitment to mission. Again, for private agencies, this was particularly one of their selling points to recruiting and retaining workers. And people would say, I love kids. I care about kids. This is what I want my professional life to be all about. We also found that some of the more resilient workers were also people who had a personal connection to child welfare. They had in some way in the past been involved with adoption or had foster parents, their families might have been fostering. There were all kinds of these stories. People had ways in which they were committed to and connected to the mission of child welfare. The second thing was a sense of accomplishment, and that is to have some sense that what they were doing made a difference. And these folks, again, who are more positive and resilient and lasting, almost always had a series of stories that they could tell themselves about how they'd had an impact in kids' lives. And for those of us who've worked in child welfare, we know that we oftentimes do what we think are the right and the best things, or we hope they are, and we may not see the results, or we may not see any positive results. But once in a while, there are these glimmers that perhaps the dedication and care relationships and knowledge and skill that we bring to our work may have an impact, and that kept people going. The third thing was the quality of supervision, and again, almost everybody had a story about a supervisor who inspired, supported, and helped them. These stories almost always had the exact same theme, which was they were never micromanaged. At the same time, they felt fully supported and that the supervisor was accessible and engaged in their work. And many of us know that that's a really tricky balance to hit, but those were the qualities that were most valued. Then the last thing we talked about was flexibility, and that had to do with that particularly in the private agencies, this was an easier thing to do because there were fewer unions and other kinds of policies to deal with. But folks liked to be able to flex their hours, to flex their work, and that made it possible for people, particularly those committed to some kind of work-life balance, to keep going. The next thing we did with regard to assessment was we asked supervisors and managers what were the things that were most important to them. And from that process, we learned that the ability to make good judgments, good decisions, and to operate in an ethical manner was the most important thing for supervisors and middle managers. Secondly, they liked the whole concepts and the importance of establishing rapport, credibility, recognizing and supporting their staff. Remember, these assessment activities are going to be used to inform our curriculum work. But in that process, we also found some interesting things. We found that women supervisors and middle managers generally ranked themselves as more competent than men did. We found that newer leaders understandably reported that they were less competent. And they all, again, particularly there was this discussion among middle managers in terms of less competence around cultural competency, setting and maintaining priorities, and, again, handling a work-life balance, which will be kind of a sub-theme for some of this as well. A third assessment piece was something that we did that we thought was great fun, and that was we wanted to know, with regard to recruitment, what is it that would get a social work student to work in child welfare? We've heard tales before from the field that schools of social work sometimes discourage students from entering child welfare, so we wanted to see whether or not that was the case, as well as to find out what messages might be most powerful for recruiting. So we did longitudinal studies where we followed bachelor students and master students over a 2-year period at 4 points in time, asking them about their impressions and their thoughts about child welfare as a profession. We're still analyzing all that longitudinal data, but there's 3 things I can highlight. One was a lot of students talked about the role of the media in terms of shaping their views of the field, and so we keep hoping for a really good primetime television show on child welfare and social workers, and so there's this role of the media piece. The second thing was that they began social work oftentimes with a high compassion and interest in helping children, and we found that in the early longitudinal points, these were the points that really were pointing people toward working in child welfare. It was this compassion for children. And again, those of us in the field know that that can be some of the frustrations, is that there are so many aspects of child welfare that really don't bring us into effective contact with children. So that eventually could be a point of some consternation for people. In the end, the final points, when we're asking students near the end of their BSW or MSW programs, what is it you're thinking about? And they all said almost overwhelmingly that they needed a job. And so I think that there's different things that that child welfare agencies can do to appeal to students, perhaps at a different point in the process. Again, we're also going to be looking at the things that our faculty did intentionally or unintentionally that may have encouraged or supported an interest in child welfare. The next assessment thing we looked at was we sent a survey to 60 people who had gained their MSWs and were still working or had gotten their MSWs while they were working in the public agency. And again, we wanted to know, why did they stay in the public agency? This mimicked our earlier study a bit in that, again, they often said that they got into this because of a field placement or a calling or a care for children. Why did they stay? And the most highly rated reason was for pay, benefits, and job stability. They did oftentimes, though, also talk about making a difference in the lives of children. And it seems like those who last are people who enjoy the fast-paced environment and don't like to be bored, like the diversity of tasks and challenges that face them in the work. We found that a very small number of these 60 people who gained their MSWs actually left the public agency. The majority of those who left because of reasons that they cited having to do with stress. We found that only one person left for private practice, and they had worked in the public department for 19 years. And again, we were trying to get at some of the myths or some of the beliefs that exist in the field, that if you support workers to get MSWs, they'll leave the department. Well, that didn't seem to be true. Or the sense that they'll leave the department and they'll want to go into some kind of a private therapeutic practice. That was not true. And for this one person who had worked for 19 years, we forgave her and thought that that was just fine that she went into private practice because she was working with kids who'd been in the foster care system. Again, 90% of these workers reported, or over 90%, that being in school, getting their MSWs while being employed at the department had a positive impact not only on their work, but also on their life. So from these assessment pieces, then, we begin to build and look at the curriculum. And this curriculum was aimed at supervisors, but there's a lot of supervisory curriculums that are out there. We wanted to focus on retention. So everything that we wrote had a retention focused, designed with adult learning principles and independent modules, so you didn't have to read from volume 1 to volume 6. You could take out 3 pages from workbook 2, because we wanted this to be very flexible, because we heard repeatedly from the agencies that they needed this flexibility in terms of delivering training, particularly aimed at supervisors. Now, this workbook series had 6 titles, and you can there's the role of leaders was the first one, because we also believe that you've got to focus on leadership at the supervisory level and those who are organizationally leaders who are supporting the supervisors. The second one was retention-focused supervision. Third one, communication skills. Fourth one, working with differences. Fifth one was the first 6 months, and this came out of our assessment as well, because most people were making decisions about staying or not staying in their agency within the first 6 months, oftentimes sooner than that. So getting off to a good start between a supervisor and the worker seemed to be essential to support retention. And then the last of the 6 workbooks was looking at recruiting and selecting employees. Now, what we did with the supervisory series then is we field tested it. We went to 4 different agencies, presented it to their leaders and teams at their agencies, and then in each agency we crafted a different training plan, because again, we didn't believe that this could be like one size fits all, and the curriculum was designed to be delivered flexibly. We ended up with 3 different models of implementation. One is we would give the curriculum, which were workbooks, again, that could be used in a self-instructional manner. So we handed them out to supervisors and said, pick and choose, use these as you want, use this on your own. They're self-instructional. The second one was a traditional classroom instruction where we had a teacher and 20-some supervisors in front of them. The third one was deliberately a train-the-trainers model where we trained the supervisors to train the curriculum to other supervisors. And those were the three models that we used to implement the curriculum. We delivered these six workbooks in a period of time of over 10 to 12 months. So there was time in between to do assignments, to learn different things, to get feedback, and to provide consultation. Some lessons that we learned from testing our supervisory curriculum was that that if you gave it to supervisors and you said, good luck, use this as you can and will, we found that after about 3 days, they never used it again, that people got very busy and there was a rapid drop-off in the use of any of the curriculum. The next thing we looked at was the traditional classroom, and we found, again, that we got pretty high satisfaction in terms of the training itself and initial reports of utilization, but then a drop-off as time went by. The third strategy, which was, again, this train-the-trainers, resulted in the highest level of satisfaction, retention of learning, and some of those supervisors who learned the curriculum ended up being involved in the rest of our project, and we hired them, in fact, as trainers. They were so effective. So it seemed, again, the more investment in and the more active the training, clearly the stronger the learning and the benefit. But in all of these cases, the key was really administrative support and agency culture as well. It made a difference whether the agency saw itself as a learning community, whether it defined itself as being a place that was constantly trying out new things, or folks in some cases that were just much more traditional in the way they went about their work. The next part of this, so the first thing we did were these assessments. The second thing we did was to develop the supervisory curriculum based on the assessment, which we delivered through these different strategies and learned some lessons from that. And I'll just say with that supervisory curriculum, too, we then moved it into the school's continuing education program so that those workshops are offered over and over again throughout the year now. It was a way of sustaining this after the grant ended as well. We then thought it would be good to dive in with two agencies, which we did because believing that training was important, but looking at a broader agency culture and organization and climate was absolutely crucial to affect the qualities that promote retention. So we worked at one agency, which defined itself as a learning organization. We placed 20 students in this one agency. We conducted monthly grand rounds that were continuing education and case conferencing. We met bimonthly with the leadership of the agency, sponsored community events with them, and then developed faculty research projects. So we basically moved in with this agency for a number of years. We called them our farm club because they would send us students. We would send them future employees. And there were a lot of things we learned from this, is that that this kind of intensive field placements in some ways provided a good pool of people for the agency to hire. But at the highest levels, this wasn't sustainable. It was just too many students and too much work. So we've lowered this down to about 10 students now annually. That seems to be a nice spot for the agency and the school. The grand rounds we were presenting went very well with regard to students, but we had hopes that agency social workers and other staff members might attend, and that didn't happen. It ended up being a grand round series almost entirely for students. The ongoing meetings with the higher level, again, were tough to sustain because oftentimes some of the top people in the agency wouldn't attend. And when that happened, then it began to just loosen up a bit some of the decision-making that we wanted to maintain. There was an annual kickoff in some of these educational conferences. Again, for a period of time, they worked well, not the kind of thing that we could sustain over a long period of time. However, faculty consultation and research has been continuing, and this has built in a series of relationships and opportunities for staff to work with faculty members. And the last thing we learned from this example one, again, was that what happened was there was a change in executive director philosophy. moving much more from a learning community model to a I need to make money model. And when that happened, there was a considerable turnover in the management staff, and we had to kind of renegotiate and figure out how to keep working with this agency, which we've been able to successfully do, but at a different level of engagement. The second intensive relationship we had was with a public county. They had about 90 child welfare workers in this county. We tried repeatedly to find ways to engage with them and ended up offering three different things: focus groups, a court consultation project where we would coach their workers who were going to court, because out of the focus groups we learned that the relationship with the court was most stressful. And then we had new worker liaison groups, which was a way of kind of hooking up new workers with each other and with additional supports, because they were losing 90% of their new hires within the first 6 months. So we had to find some way to try to support the supervisors, support the new staff, and connect and see if this might begin to stem some of the attrition. Learned a couple examples here. The first thing, the focus groups worked really well engaging in this county. We had over 90 participants over a two-day period in small groups. We quickly identified kind of low-lying fruit, which gave the administration something to act on, and they began to change some things right away. They developed a welcoming committee for new workers. They addressed some of the safety issues that workers had raised, and they began to look at some new ways to support training. For the court consultation project, didn't get off the ground. The agency workers just didn't connect with what they were able to pull off in the time frames that they needed to with regard to going to court. And the new worker liaison groups we started up the agency ended up sending workers to those who had been on the job for sometimes 2 years or 1.5 years. So they didn't end up having the same kind of dynamic it would be if those group were composed of people who had just been newly hired. We recalibrated, and now we're still working with this agency even though the grant period has ended, and we've pulled back to doing on-site workshops and training during lunch hours to strengthen our work there. So let me just wrap up a bit. We talk about retention is about organizational culture and climate. It takes a lot of time and endurance to do this. Leadership is, we found, was certainly the key to making this work. But again, one of the takeaways from this, too, was the importance of curriculum and structure for that. And that curriculum is on our website for people to be able to look at to gain that information from our project. Sorry to talk so quickly, but again, I would encourage you to look at our website to find both the assessment information and the curriculum products there for you to look at. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Gary. And as Gary reminded us, this information is on all of the project websites, and you have project abstracts posted on the Resource Center website, and you can find our project websites there. Does anyone have questions of Gary before we move to Iowa?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have questions or comments, please press the 1 button on your touch-tone keypad. I'm showing a question or comment, this one from Pamela Foster. Your line is open.
Yes, this is Julian Wagner from Hamilton County. I just wanted to know the website that Gary was referring to, the website address.
You bet. The website address is www.socialwork, which is one word, .msu.edu. And again, all the assessment reports, all the measurement tools, and the curriculum is all there for free and downloadable.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, I'm showing one other in queue, or pardon me, two in queue. The first one from Pat Gomez. Your line is open.
Hi, this is not Pat Gomez. This is June Lloyd in Region 6, the regional office. Gary, we were wondering if when you referred several times to what attracted students to social work as being compassion for children, if you were using that as shorthand for desire to work with children and families, or if you really meant that there was very little interest in working with families as opposed to children?
June, that's a great question. We really meant children. I think the appeal is for students, oftentimes like it is for the public, it's this kind of child rescuing viewpoint of what child welfare is about. Having this compassion and concern for children isn't a bad thing, but certainly then it suggests that one of the jobs for us at school is going to be to broaden that to a family perspective and looking at the whole family, not just the child. And if we do our job well, then hopefully that's going to be not quite the hurdle when they enter the field of child welfare.
Thank you. Is there another question, Matt?
Yes, I have one more in queue, this one from Yesenia Suarez.
Yeah, I couldn't get the website. He said www.socialwork. He said it too fast. I couldn't get it down.
Yeah, my apologies. It's because I used to live in New York for a while that I picked up these bad habits. www.socialwork.msu.edu.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So it's for Michigan State University, EDU.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
And again, this is the abstracts of all 8 of the recruitment and retention projects are posted on the Resource Center website. You can get them there. So you can download all of the material from all of our projects.
Yeah, this is Mary. The email that you got with the phone number for today's call has the link to that Resource Center website. And if you go there to the teleconference section on December 4th, there's this document that will give you the links to all of the sites.
With abstracts,
yeah,
of the project. Okay, thank you so much, Gary. Iowa, Miriam, and Margie?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'm Miriam Lansman from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, and Margie Poorman from the Iowa Department of Human Services is out there. Hi, Margie.
Hello, everyone. Yes, I'm here.
Thanks. And our project is a collaboration between my university and the Iowa Department of Human Services. And just since the others said a little bit about their state, I'll just say that Iowa is a state administered system that has 99 counties, which in 2002 were reorganized into 8 service areas, along with eliminating a lot of management and supervisory positions, which created some special challenges for us as we started to write our proposal for this project. And turnover in Iowa is not a high turnover state, typically more higher turnover in the more urban areas than in the less urban or more rural areas. And in fact, the greatest challenge in the workforce in Iowa is probably the aging of the workforce, more so than preventable turnover. But I'll move on from here. I have more slides than I have time to really go over. So some of this is going to be for your review later on. I am trying to multitask here. Okay, I'm trying to move ahead. Here we go. Okay. Say that our project and all of the recruitment and retention projects were based on a generation of child welfare force research that really started to look at some of the organizational factors contributing to turnover. And some of these factors are on my slide right here. Supervision, service orientation, mission, caring. This is called different things in different studies. Work overload, organizational support, co-worker support, promotional opportunities, organizational climate, and social work education. And the two items that I've put in bold here, supervision and social work education, are the focus of my presentation here. We organized our retention activities through a statewide program of supervisor training, and we focused our recruitment activities by developing a child welfare specialization at University of Iowa School of Social Work. So supervision, there's quite a lot of research on the in the child welfare workforce that addresses supervision as a very key variable in staff retention. In fact, I think the most consistent finding across studies points to the importance of supervision. And I'm not going to go through too much detail here, only to say that an important role enhancing job satisfaction, commitment, and retention. It's well known that supervisors have a key role in mentoring their workers. Supervisors can mediate the effects of stressful working conditions and stressful job demands. And they can provide opportunities to develop skills that increase organizational citizenship behaviors and improve performance. So these are just some of the studies that have looked at supervision. Many studies have pointed to supervision as a very important factor. With regard to social work education, there is some evidence in the research that the 4E MSW training program helped to enhance workers to stay in child welfare. Also some evidence that 4E trained social workers have stronger knowledge and skills. Now the research on simply having a social work degree is a little more mixed. Some studies find that having a social work degree is associated with retention. Others find no effect. Some even find a negative effect. So I think the takeaway message is that having a social work degree is probably more important in retention when that educational program can be more focused on the issues that come up in child welfare social work. So when we looked at our recruitment, and again, our recruitment activities focused on our social work education, according to a survey that we conducted early on in our project, we found that 9% of Department of Human Services employees held an MSW degree, 47% held a Bachelor's of Social Work. And we also knew that our School of Social Work did not offer specific courses to prepare students for child welfare careers. It's much more of a generalist program. So what we did was focused on strengthening our curriculum in child welfare. We developed a child welfare field of practice for MSW and BSW students. So at each level of education, a series of courses and activities to prepare students for that more specialized area of practice. And through our project, we also developed 3 new courses specific to child welfare, child welfare policy and practice, clinical issues in child welfare, and supervision in child welfare. And that's really what I'm going to say about this aspect of our project. I'm going to spend most of the time now on our retention activities, which was our supervisor training program. So what we did in this program is we first conducted a baseline statewide employee survey, conducted focus groups in all of the 8 service areas in the state to obtain supervisor input into what their life was like as a supervisor, what was working well, what were their challenges, what would they like to see in a training program, because I might not have remembered to say that prior to our project, there really was not a supervisor training program for DHS supervisors. So this was going to be a new program, and we really wanted to get as much input as we could. And we developed then an 8-day supervisor training program with input from Iowa supervisors for Iowa supervisors. We developed a model of supervision, which I'm going to talk more about. We implemented the training twice statewide, and then we conducted evaluation activities of the usefulness and knowledge gain from this training. And our first lesson learned, I'm interspersing our lessons learned with some of the information about our program, was that seeking input from supervisors early in the process helped to increase the relevance and their own investment in the program. And one of our first findings from our evaluation is that between 80 and 98% of supervisors participated in the training. And we attribute this at least in part to the way that we involved them in the development of this program. It was their program. Okay. Implementation. Our curriculum content was discussed with a statewide advisory committee that met monthly throughout the 5 years of our project. And our monthly meetings were either by telephone, and more every maybe twice a year or so we would have statewide in-person meetings. But we talked, you know, every month we would talk about curriculum content. We implemented the training in 4 geographically mixed groups, and this was at the supervisor's request. So rather than conduct this training locally, the supervisors were mixed from different areas of the state. All of our training was held in Des Moines, which is the more central location. But people really wanted an opportunity to get together with their colleagues that they don't see regularly. So that's why we mixed them geographically. Each module was delivered in 1 to 2 days, again, at their request. It's hard for supervisors to get a lot of time away from the office. We broke it up into 2-day segments. And then we field tested each module with one group and then revised it and delivered it to the other group. And our trainings included lectures, small group work, discussions, and also some breakout workshops where supervisors had a choice of attending different workshops, and that seemed to work very well. Okay, and our second lesson learned is that supervisors appreciated and benefited from opportunities to interact with peers from across the state, and that more opportunities for peer support for supervisors are needed. This was supported in our evaluation data from open-ended comments that really reinforced the value of opportunities for peer support. It's a difficult job, and it can be a lonely job, especially in a state like Iowa that, as I mentioned earlier, was reorganized into a smaller number of geographically dispersed service areas where people just didn't have a lot of time to network with each other and to get support and to learn from each other. So I think that was really a very important lesson that we learned. Okay, our baseline survey was a web-based survey we conducted with all of the child welfare employees in the first year. We had a 59% response rate, which was lower than I would have liked, but I guess it's enough. And this survey measured perceptions of the workplace, supports and stressors, job demands, job satisfaction, commitment, and intentions to stay. Now, we looked at organizational commitment as a precursor to retention. A lot of the workforce literature, not only in child welfare, but in many occupations and professions, looks at organizational commitment, which is defined as the relative strength of the individual's identification with and involvement in the employing organization. And the idea is, when you have strong organizational commitment, you're going to have stronger intentions to stay, and then actually stronger staying behaviors. So, in our baseline survey, I used a model that was developed by some other researchers in a different occupation altogether, but they posited that there really are 2 pathways to achieving this organizational commitment. One of them is through job satisfaction, which is an emotional response to the job, the degree to which somebody likes their job. And that's a typical way that we think of, you know, that organizational commitment is achieved through job satisfaction. The other pathway, which comes out of social exchange theory, looks at perceived organizational support, which is really an evaluative appraisal of how strong the organizational values and cares about the employee. So we looked at these 2 different pathways through which attachment to the organization can be achieved. And we entered a lot of different variables, factors of the workplace, into this model. And what we found, and I'm not going to go through this entire model with you, but I want to highlight for you is supervisor support, which is right in the middle here, is the only variable in our model that actually affects commitment by increasing satisfaction of the employees and by increasing the degree to which they feel that they're valued. And so we think that supervisory support has a very strong role in producing commitment. If anyone's interested in the rest of it, I can talk to you some other time, but it's just too much to go through that, all of these findings. So our lesson learned here, again, was that supervisory support affects commitment in multiple ways, and that investing in supervisors through training and mentoring may be a very fruitful strategy to improve staff commitment and retention. So this validated what we were planning to do and also pointed us to how we need to think about supervisor support. Okay, so key concepts in our model of supervision. Supervision is an intentional practice that requires programming. It's not simply something that happens in the doorway, on the way in and out the door, but it has to be an intentional practice. We have the concepts of the learning organization, of parallel process, a developmental individualized approach, strength-based reflective supervision, competency-based, and cultural competence. And I'm not going to have time to talk about all of these aspects, so I am going to focus on a few. And one of them I think is really relevant is the notion of parallel process. Because as we talk about in practice with families, we talk about strengths and supporting and strengthening families. But what we learned when we listened to supervisors talking about how they supervise, we found that strength-based philosophy didn't always carry over to how they handled their workers and how do they handle supervision. So we wanted to reinforce strength-based practice, not only in practice with families, but in practice in supervision. So that is a very important principle in our supervision training. So the idea is it's strength-based developmental supervision principles where every staff member, including the supervisor, is constantly learning and adapting to changing responsibilities. We understand that mastery proceeds developmentally, that every person has unique contributions and strengths, and that a comprehensive supervision program allows the supervisor to assess and build upon staff strengths in order to fulfill the program's purposes and to develop staff competence. And so we built a model where we look at the worker in terms of developmental stages and where focus is on increase in working with and assessing and working with workers as they develop their competence over time. We talked about reflective supervision that as opposed to remediative supervision, which is more corrective, but reflective supervision that really elicits from the worker their competence and capacities and experiences, encourages workers to generate solutions to their practice dilemmas rather than simply giving them the answer, you know, what to do in this case, but instead to help them to think about their own problem-solving skills. It also addresses the supervisor-supervisee relationship, enhances worker self-reflection and critical thinking, and ultimately promotes worker self-efficacy that we believe is key to workers developing the competence that they need to build investment. Our model also looks at individualizing supervision by identifying worker skill levels, learning styles, and then matching supervisory interventions to worker skill level and learning preferences. And what our lesson learned from this is that developing a model of supervision reinforced supervision as its own model of practice. Our evaluation data found between pre- and post-tests of knowledge demonstrated significant increase for between 87 and 99% of participants, that supervisors increased their reported use of these skills over six-month measurement intervals. And turnover data, excluding retirements that we are still looking at, revealed that 4.3% left the agency in the first year after the project began 4.1% in the second year, and we are still looking at the remaining data and hope to have that completed very soon. Okay. The last few slides in here actually talk about the details of what we have in each of our supervisor curriculum modules. And so I'm not going to get into that in these few minutes here. But I want to just point out that our last module, which had to do with the supervisor's role in addressing worker stress and safety, leading positive change, and public and community relations, ended up focusing a lot on these issues of vicarious trauma, compassion fatigue, and self-care. And even though we originally this module was developed to help supervisors work with their staff in on these issues, what we found out is that they benefited from this for themselves, much as for their staff. And so this is one of our lessons. And our trainers had to kind of shift gears a bit in this, because they really had to focus actually more on the supervisors than was probably the original intention. But we think that more attention to self-care for supervisors is in order. You know, supervisors, they're supposed to be strong. They're supposed to be helping their staff, but they may not be anyone there for them to process some of this trauma with. So that was another important lesson that we learned. Our next steps. We are finalizing our training curriculum and tools for dissemination. We are doing a follow-up statewide employee survey, which will allow us to look at how did perceptions of the workplace change over time. As I mentioned, we're finishing the compilation of turnover and job change data to look at what trends were identified in turnover and job changes and how changes in perception of the workplace might be related to retention, comparing the baseline and follow-up survey data. So that is, and the rest of my slides are just what's in each particular module. So I will stop now. I've probably gone over my time. So thank you. Margie, is there anything you wanted to add?
No, other than I think that the early involvement, as you mentioned, with the supervisors was a real key point for us, and it kept the momentum building throughout all the years that, and with the monthly meetings of the training committee as well, our advisory committee.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we have any questions?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or comment, please press the 1 button on your touch-tone keypad. Yes, our first question or comment comes from Candace Britt. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. I wondered if you'd be willing to share the survey that you used with the child welfare staff.
Sure. It's a web-based survey. Do you want the the one we've already done or the one we're going to do? A lot of similar items, but we're going to ask a few more questions
Well, if you could share both, that'd be great. We're doing some supervision work here, and I think it would be helpful.
Do you want to zip me an email with how to get it to you?
Yeah, we could, Miriam, we could do that as one possibility. The agenda has Miriam Lansman email on it, or if other people are interested, this is Mary from the Resource Center. We can send it out to everybody who registered for the call, or post it on our website. But I don't know, if you want to share it that much. Let's figure out the best way. The person who asked that question, do you have the agenda with Miriam's email?
I should have that information.
Right, or maybe other people can comment if they're interested. And if other people are interested, we can send it out in an email to everyone who registered.
Thank you.
Okay, are there any other questions?
Again, if you have a question or comment, please press the 1 button. Our next question in queue is from Shauna Banheyer. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Shauna from Boise State University. And you mentioned a little bit about the evidence in the 4E MSW-trained workers more likely to stay in child welfare. Do you have any specific information on your programs related to retention with those 4E students?
You know, I don't have that information. I wonder if, Margie, do you know if DHS collects that?
You know, currently we do not collect that information.
Okay.
If I could add, at Michigan State, one of our assessment tools was really with the 4E folks at the department, so we do have a little bit of data on that. And again, we found that that about 87% of the people who responded had stayed at the department, and we've got a range of things with regard to their satisfaction.
Okay, is that part of the data that's online there at Michigan State?
It's not there yet, but it will be within a month.
Okay, great, thank you.
Yeah, you know, the other thing, the information I presented was some research by other people on.
Mm-hmm.
And if mm-hmm. you have those citations, I could get those to you.
I think I may have something similar, but I can definitely just, I have your PowerPoint, so I can look up that information myself so you don't have to get it to me. Thank you, though.
Okay, any other questions?
Thank you. Again, if you do have a question, please press the 1 button at this time. Yes, our next question is from Mike Lessman. Your line is open.
Yeah, this is actually a question for Mr. Anderson. Gary, I'm looking at your website, and I think I heard you say earlier that you had a lot of these tools on the website. Is the supervisory workbook series actually out there?
Yes, all 6 workbooks should be there, downloadable. The website might take a little navigating. You have to go, there's a section called Outreach and Research on the front page. That will take you to a section that identifies a number of projects. Among those projects is the Recruitment and Retention Project, and on the pages dedicated to that project is a link to the downloadable workbooks.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, this is Frieda again. One of our goals through all of the projects has been to disseminate useful information to the field. So all of our products are being posted on our website and on the gateway. Are there any other questions?
Currently, I'm showing no other questions from the phone line.
Again, this is Frieda, and I have a couple of findings from the main project that I thought that people might be interested in. We took a comprehensive approach to the issue of recruitment and retention and perhaps focused a little more on recruitment and selection than the projects who are reporting today talked about. And I thought you might be interested to hear a couple of our findings. One, we did do more realistic recruitment and screening. We developed a realistic job preview. And we found that two-thirds of all the new hires in our pre-service program found out about the job on the Internet, which was a big surprise to us because in the past we've done newspaper ads and job fairs and classroom visits and so on, but I think this new generation of workers are finding out about jobs on the Internet, so I think that's important for us to know. We also did competency-based selection, and we've got some interesting findings from that. One of them, and I feel really good about this one, is that the turnover rate in the first 6 months and the first year on the job has been cut in half in the last 4 years that the project has been operational. In the past, about a third of the people leaving the agency were leaving in the first year, and we've cut that down to about a fifth of that, so that feels pretty good. And our screening tools is showing that there's a correlation between the rating and the panel interview and the performance on the job, so that
competency-based screening tool is a valid predictor of job performance. And then another finding that I'm feeling really good about is that the average length of service of caseworkers has increased during the 4 years of the project from about 3 years in 2004 to over six years in 2007. And we're not claiming all of the credit for that because I think a lot of that has to do with environmental factors and the state of the economy, but I'm hopeful that at least some of it has to do with the interventions that we were involved in. We also did an analysis of the cost of turnover, and we found that the cost is about $17,000 per caseworker. So if you multiply that figure by the number of caseworkers who leave your agency in a year, it comes up to a substantial amount and shows that it's really worthwhile putting resources into retaining people. So, and again, all of this data is posted on the project website. Are there any other questions from the group? No?
If there are any additional questions, please press the 1 button on your touchtone keypad at this time. I'm showing no further questions.
This is Mary from the Research Center. I'll just say that this is the third in a series of calls on these recruitment and retention projects, as Frieda mentioned. The last one on May 20th, 2008, did highlight three of the other sites and some of the work that they were doing, particularly around recruitment and selection. So the materials from those calls and also the audio tapes are also on our website. That www.nrcoi.org is another resource. So if anybody has any other comments or questions, as Matthew has said, you can just push one on your phone.
I'm showing one more. This one from Alan Kalischer. Your line is open.
Hello. I just have a comment because one of the things we've done in Connecticut certainly has been to try to build a bunch of these kinds of strategies into our recruitment and retention practices. And on the fairly recent side is trying to develop competency-based behavioral interview questions. And recently I've just been focusing quite a bit on it, actually from this perspective of a panelist. And I've been noticing, actually kind of surprisingly, just how many people struggle to offer relevant answers. What I'm finding is a lot of candidates will tell stories. So when asked to give an example of whatever, they're telling a story that's somewhat relevant, but leaving out the detail that's most pertinent, which is often their own role and anything that would actually reveal their own values or anything that actually kind of show their approach and competencies in the areas that are asking. So I'm just curious if anyone in, and I know, Frieda, I know you've done a lot of work in Maine on this. I just wonder if any of these groups who've been institutionalizing these strategies have encountered a difficulty in that way, what you found has compensated for it, or any other insights you have.
Hi, Alan.
Hi, Frieda.
Good to hear from you. I would just comment that the research shows that high performers are able to focus and provide considerable detail about events in the past. So behavioral event interviewing shows that when you have a high performer, you're likely to get rich information from them. So that might give you a clue. You know, if someone's being vague or, you know, not talking about their specific role, that might give you a clue around that. The other thing is that you can use prompts and follow-ups so that the interview team can help the person focus more if they're being vague. They can say, you know, well, that's really interesting, but tell me more specifically about what you did and what your role was. It's fine to do that.
Well, that's it's good to hear. Two things that I've been trying to do to compensate. One is that it doesn't always work. I find that maybe it's just unique to our setting, but I find that the atmosphere often is one like it's a test rather than an actual conversation and a dialogue. And I think that inhibits people and even panelists from feeling like they can prompt very much. The concern with labor issues, fairness and equity and things like that come into play. But the other thing that I was trying was to ask a general statement about how do you handle this type of situation and give me an example. And at least that has seemed to help a little bit. But I guess I'm curious about, you know, I've looked at different examples of behavioral questions and many are not typically structured that way. But I have found that asking for both a general kind of response and an example either helps to get people focused and reinforce it with an example, or sometimes, that interestingly enough, we've heard answers that completely contradict each other. So I thought that was kind of interesting, too.
Yeah. On our website, Helen, there's a monograph that I did on screening, and it has some information on developing questions that might be helpful to you.
Good.
And you know, you're also welcome to call me, and we can talk more.
Good, I will. Thanks.
Okay.
Great. Well, we are at the end of our time here, so I think we better be wrapping this up. This is Mary O'Brien from the Resource Center. Thank you to everyone for coming. Thanks very much to our presenters, Mary McCarthy and Paul Brady and Gary Anderson and Miriam Landsman and Margie Portman. Thank you all for coming to talk with us about your work. And thank you, everyone, for attending. As I have up on the screen there, we would ask everyone to fill in the online evaluation form that we have. You know, we sent that link to you in the email that had the phone number for today's call. And if you fill it out and send it back in, we'd really appreciate your feedback. We do use those to improve these sessions. I'll follow up with Iowa in terms of those supervisor surveys and send another email out to everyone who registered with some information about those. And feel free to contact, you know, any of the presenters or us at the Resource Center if you need any more help with any of these issues. And again, thank you everyone for coming.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's call. This does conclude the program, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.